shortly.
That's
sir.
Okay.
Actually, you know, I forgot. I'd very much like to get a glass of.
You want
to? May I also get a glass of orange juice, please?
Orange juice, absolutely, sir.
Thanks. I've just written my youngest. Seven. She's, it was her last day at the kindergarten today, and have a big ceremony, a big kind of graduation from kindergarten.
You're talking to him in England?
Her in it, yeah. Yes. So she just had it. So.
How many children do you have?
Three. The eldest is 15, and then I've got a 10-year-old, and then a 7-year-old.
Which of the three seem to be... inclined to go in your direction, if any?
The eldest is, he's doing drama at school. He specialises in drama and art. He's really into art and fine art and design.
When is it that, at what point in your, I presume your teenage years, when did you first receive the notion that you might have a certain facility at writing and staging? And
I used to, at school, I did my first stand-up when I was 11. I used to listen to lots of radio comedy. And at school, they'd put on these sort of charity evenings to raise money and stuff like that. And I was asked to compare and stuff. And I would just steal jokes off the radio that I'd just, you know, utter theft.
So you must have been... thinking about it when you were 9 or 10, if you got around to it.
Yeah, I suppose. But I just always enjoyed listening to funny things. And in the UK, there's always this great traditional radio comedy. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was my first job, actually. I became a radio comedy. I became a music presenter, but I was able to do comedy and record it, do different voices, or get people in, direct them, and put the sound effects on, and do the editing, and so the whole production process. Oh, great, thank you.
I think one of the first and most robust pleasures of In the Loop is the wonderfully creative and liberal use of absolutely disgusting profanity. It's really one of some of the funniest uses of it. And I was just wondering, was every word of it pretty much scripted, or did you, or is that...
More or less, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we do improvisation, but that's really just to loosen the script up and make it feel a bit more natural. But with Malcolm's, specifically Malcolm's swearing, it's so, it has to be so precisely done that, you know, he does it syllable for syllable as on the page.
I had this idea as I was watching it that it's something about the genteel sound of a Whitehall accent that it might not come off if you were happened to be an American, you were doing this in the Pentagon or something. American accent, something a little coarser about that sound. I don't know. Just, I particularly love the way the women give as well as they get.
Yeah. So. But I think in that environment they have to, don't they? Otherwise they're treated as
right.
I was remembering when I was out in Washington doing sort of research and meeting people who worked as staffers and State Department people and so on. There was a woman there who was sort of mid-30s and so on. She said sometimes she would go into meetings and there'd be about 10 people there and she's the only woman. And she said people would look at her as if, why aren't you going to get the coffee?
Yeah. You know, we're talking about within a couple of years ago or last year?
Yes, this was, when did I do the research? So we shot it last summer, so it must have been tail end of the year before it came out. Yeah, in November, and then again in January of last year. Yeah.
Were you finished, did you finish shooting it, say, in August of last summer? So you didn't have a whole lot of time to cut it together, because you had to submit it to Sundance by, I think it was last October.
That's right. I think we finished shooting July. Started the edit, did a pickup day in August, signed the edit off early October.
Is it a natural thing that comes from working television to cut faster?
It may be. I mean, it was a long edit.
It was
about 4 or 5 months. You know, it was longer than the shoot, the edit.
But if you finished in August and submitted by October, it would be 3 months.
August, was it August? No, we finished. Thank you. finish sort of mid July.
Okay.
Is he coming?
You looking for Adam?
Well, he's through there, so I don't know.
Oh, that's the same thing. Yeah.
excuse me.
He's sitting out in the lobby. I think he wants to eat it out there, if that's possible.
All right, so absolutely, I would bring...
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right.
I think that's the confusion, really.
Because, I mean, you haven't done it repeatedly, but I have the idea that if Sundance knows they've got someone who's good, and did they were they shown the whole film in a rough...
Yeah, we showed them... the cut, but it was the offline, so and I think there were a couple of scenes missing because we were still working on it, so I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as it was signed off, we sent them the finished thing, but I think it was still an offline. They knew the whole post-production was happening beyond their deadline, so we just about made it in terms of deadline here.
It's almost like I've tried to describe how one knows that you're in the you're watching a comedy that is working, and you get the feeling either two things have happened. One, all the cast members have gone to some kind of comedy boot camp and had it drilled into them that there's a certain mentality, a certain attitude, or something that because they're all of a piece. Mm. That, or they've all taken the same hallucinogenic drug.
Well, but they work as a unit for some time before we start the shoot. We did about 3 weeks of rehearsals. Prior to that, we got as many of them as were available, each draft of the script.
You got Gandolfini to do
a read and stuff.
Rehearsal
and
then, in London?
We came out to New York, and we get the UK cast who were filming the Washington scenes came out, and we spent a week here doing rehearsals and doing workshops and improvisations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We brought a writer came out as well, so that he could reshape some of the scenes on the basis of James came out and we did 5 days of rehearsals. Then James went off to the Pentagon and spoke to generals and because he wanted to see how they talked, how they moved, what their attitudes were. And
did you happen to see his performance in Taking a Pelham 1-2-3?
I haven't seen that yet. No, he's the mayor, isn't he?
He's really got it's a wonderful silhouette. I've seen him in the play. Have you seen him in the
God of Carnage? Yeah. Great, isn't it? Great. He's such a funny guy. You know, he's got so much, you know, it's that thing of being recognized for a particular part, and then you realize that's just a part. You know, he's an actor.
Yeah.
Well, he's got such a visual sense as well.
Right.
Comedy and timing.
He's extremely quick and light on his feet.
Yeah.
And it's not so much just the Tony Soprano part, but he doesn't look like a Renaissance comedian. He looks like a guy who, you know, might be a producer or might be a longshoreman or something. You know, he doesn't look... but it's delightful to realize that here early on that he's in this whole thing. Mm. So, anyway.
And in the shoot, he was still improvising.
Mm-hmm.
That whole scene where he's having Chinese meal with Mimi Kennedy, and on the script it says... You know, she says, "Have you read the report?" And the script says, "Yes, I've read it. I'm the Gore Vidal of the Pentagon." And then Mimi, off script, just went, "Gore's gay." No, he's not. Yeah, he's gay. Well, I better stop saying that. I've been saying I'm Gore Vidal. I better stop. You know, and all that was just them riffing, you know, on set.
Do you need to, after something is done, and do you need to kind of go off into the country or sleep for 3 weeks to get another thing, or do you like to just keep moving? And
well, I kind of until I mean after the film after I finished the film the next thing we've gone on to I shot a TV series which I'm in the middle of editing just now, but I'm going to take a little bit of time off at the end of the year. I'm going to take a couple of months of just not actively making something, but just
Can you just think about what the next
thing is? Isn't there a little man inside you that wants to keep going all the time?
No, I think this part of me wants to keep going until I know I've got to stop, and then I stop, and I want to do nothing for a while.
It's funny, I was reading about this is New York Times just a day ago, I think, about how Americans have their ability to do precisely that. It's their completely failure that they can't
stop.
They can't turn off their handhelds.
It's very difficult, yeah.
They get worried about email piling up.
Yeah. It's just an anxiety that just... It's information anxiety, isn't it? It's I've come out here this week, I decided not to bring my laptop, so that I'm not doing this and checking that, and feels a lot better.
I always thought, see, that if you're, that you would want to have, the moments, the ideas, the lines, these things come to you in the shower, they come to you anywhere, and you got to get it down within a couple of hours.
And I've also found that, actually, when I go on holiday, and again, I don't bring mobiles and Blackberries and things on holiday.
Yeah.
Usually in the second week of my holiday, I've had a really good idea.
Right.
And that's the thing I want to do. But it's not like I'm spending my time on holiday consciously thinking about it. It's that thing of you've got to step back and detach yourself from your work, and then when you least expect it, suddenly something pops up.
For me, it's driving on long trips.
Yes, yes.
When you're really doing nothing, that's when
And it sort of struck me that, I mean, what happens in politics is that they can't switch off. They're not allowed to switch off. Mm. You know, the 24-hour news cycle, the international.
Right.
There are no points in the day when they can just go, look, I'm just going to go and lie down for, I'm going to take a walk.
I think I asked you when we first spoke whether you felt that the best place for you to work was out of England, and not to really look for much for anything that might be offered or an option to make something in this country, a film, a feature, whatever. Do you feel that way, or am I confusing you with somebody?
No. I specifically want to make my own projects, and I want to be based in the UK, and you know, I've got a young family, and I don't particularly want to uproot them, and but quite happy to sort of come over and shoot stuff here and so on, but I don't want to be based you know, away from home, really. You know, as a result of maybe Sundance and then the picture being released here.
Sorry, make it feel a little bit more comfortable.
Oh, yes. Come on, I can put it here. There we go. You know, the whole thing of... thank you. You know, people in LA saying, come and visit us when you're there, and maybe we can talk about stuff and so on. And I kind of... Because I've seen it happen to other people, and what happens is, yes, you sign up, and then you just get... just inundated with scripts and projects and so on. I feel, well, I'm not really, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to do someone else's script. I don't want to do someone else's project. I want to, you know, I want to do my next thing, really.
Sure.
I think it would be good also to make films in the UK that aren't necessarily, like, heritage films, aren't... costume dramas, and you know, and there are, it's great there are things like Shaun of the Dead and you know, the Simon Pegg movies, and I just think it'd be nice to just have a confidence about doing your own projects, and nothing too big, nothing too extravagant that then needs lots of outside forces and kind of putting money in and then telling you what to do. So don't know how realistic that is, but
yeah. I'm thinking that there's... I'm trying to think of an American comedy in recent years that has this kind of vigor and
right.
And that springy step that it has. And the overwhelming majority are geared towards under 25. But they don't have a fraction of the mental alertness, you know. It's just, and it's
go back to like the 30s and 40s, I think, you know, the sort of screwball. You look at Preston Sturges' film, I mean, the lines there are just like that, and you sort of want to pause and go back and hear it again, because it was so good, and the delivery was so low-key, and, you know, it's great.
Sullivan's Travels,
and Lady Eve, just a lot of those Barbara Stanwyck's lines are just killer lines that she just throws away. And
have you had any conversations with any people that are interested in trying to work with you that have said in so many words, your stuff is great? I don't know if the demo is alert or fast enough to get how good your stuff is.
Oh, right, okay. Part of my trip to LA is just to meet a few people. Uh-huh. But I what I want to do, I mean, it was a joy working with that cast, and I really, that's the first time I've worked with an American cast, and the casting process, I met many other sort of funny people, and so I really would like to start thinking about people I really want to have in.
Well, if I were a major comedian, if I were a Jim Carrey or a Steve Martin, I would absolutely consider it vital to somehow work with you, you know, somewhere down the line, sooner or later. But there's just not that many people. There are not that many people that are really know how to do this sort of thing, or even care to do this sort of thing well. I mean, as I said, maybe it's market forces.
Right, yes.
But it's just delightful.
Oh, great. Oh, thank you.
It was great. I stepped in and saw it a little bit a second time in Sundance, just to hear the press responding to it at the Yarrow Hotel, and that was a lot of fun.
That's been the nicest thing for me, actually, is because when you do television, you don't know how it's being perceived. You know, when it goes out, it's not like you're there with a large group of people watching it.
Is that considered an unnecessary indulgence to have an actual audience watch a filming or a taping of a TV?
Well, only if you want the laughter on the recording. I mean, you'd get people doing screenings and so on, but...
Did anybody do that in England? Or is that pretty
not
much
really,
gone?
No.
Yeah.
But it was great doing the film and then watching it for the first time in an audience. And that slight edge of fear that they're all going to just sit silently throughout and not get any of it. And so when the first laugh comes, and you're just a relief, and then you hear the laughter, it's great.
Not so much obviously you hear the laughter, but I you know, when a live comedy in front of an audience is really going well, the audience has has a way of, you know, energizing and adding to the whole thing, making it funnier than you might have, even the creators might have anticipated.
But my memory is of, well, my brother always used to take me to the latest, like, Woody Allen films, and going to see films like Airplane, and, you know, really funny joke. Sitting in a room full of people just all laughing hysterically, it's just great. And I've always wanted to make something that does that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what about the old showbiz cliche that all comedians, most comedians, are on their own?
I'm miserable.
Yeah, doleful, miserable.
Well, I don't...
You don't seem to...
No, I don't get that, really. I don't...
How about observationally, outside your own case? Do you find that to be the...
No.
No?
No. Now, I don't know whether it is I've always... A lot of my work is very collaborative anyway, so I always gravitate towards people who are very generous, you know, in terms of their not wanting to... You know, they don't want all the good lines for themselves, so they want to keep their their scripted ideas quiet. A lot of my stuff has been people having to just join in and react off against each other and so on. And it's always been a good atmosphere. And I don't really know how you can do comedy if there's a tense atmosphere on set, or if someone's being difficult. Or
well, what I have always felt or heard that the it's not tension, angry tension, but kind of a there's just something.
It's a mood. Yeah, moodiness.
Kind of a gloomy depression.
Yeah.
It's not. I'm not saying that it is expressed, but it's down there, deep down. You know.
But there is that thing of the more it becomes your sort of professional life, then the less it drifts into your private life. So that, you know, when you were, you know, when I was in my 20s and whatever, I'd probably just naturally want to make people laugh. But then as you become someone whose job that is, I probably, you know, when I'm with people socially, I'm not trying to do jokes, and, you know, I'm just... So people have said to me, who hadn't met me before, but maybe meet me socially, I know that they then said, oh, he was a bit quiet, I was expecting him to be, you know. And it's not that you're consciously just... It's just you part of you just thinks, oh, I won't do all that, because I've been doing that all day.
You know? Yeah, speaking of stand-up, another... sort of quasi-legend you hear about comedians is that when they go to see other people doing stand-up, most comedians will just go, oh, yeah, that's good, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. They won't laugh. They'll just kind of give it a point. They'll rate it.
Yeah.
And I find I kind of... I don't watch a lot of comedy at home. I'll just watch the odd program that just makes me laugh rather than watch a new comedy to assess whether it's working or what the interesting things about it. And I kind of just want to just gravitate towards things that just make you a viewer again, rather than a kind of professional.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than a reviewer.
Do you happen to have you had a chance to see either Borat or Bruno?
I've seen Borat. I haven't seen Bruno yet. Borat, I really enjoyed, but there's a friend of mine wrote it, Peter Bainham, who we write Alan Partridge with, which was Steve Coogan's chat show character. And he came out to LA to write Borat.
But I'm trying to make a point about how some things, though, you think back upon them, and each situation is pretty damn inventive.
Yeah,
funny.
Yeah.
But somehow it doesn't quite translate into actually laughing. I guess I'm talking about...
Oh, I see, right, yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I remember watching... I was watching some films on the plane, and I was quite enjoying them, but I wasn't... Maybe doing that thing you were saying. I'm just going, yeah, that's funny. Oh, that's clever, yeah. That's well-structured.
Talking to a friend the other day about people that... are overly demonstrative in their appreciation for the people that laugh relentlessly. After at a certain point, you know, I almost feel like turning around. Shut you have to laugh at
stop
you
enjoying it.
It's funny.
The person on the plane next to me, I don't know what it was she was watching, but just on the way, and you've got the headphones on, all the way through it, she was just going. Kind of put me off.
You weren't by any chance... Are you actually staying at this place?
Stay here, yeah.
Are the rooms smallish, or what are they like? Are they big?
They're smallish, yeah.
Smallish, sorry.
It's kind of weird because it's all glass.
Yeah.
So your room is very public.
Yeah.
The bathroom is weird because there are no curtains. But there are little things in the glass, little dots, which I imagine are from the outside... You can't see in, but it's a bit unnerving.
I love the beautiful look of it. It reminds me, what's the name of that building in London that has that kind of phallic shape?
Oh, the Gherkin. The Lloyd's building. Is it the Lloyd's building? Yeah.
Is that Lloyd's, as in Lloyd's of London?
Yes. Right?
Okay.
Yes.
And that was built about, what, 10,
about
12
10 years ago? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is quite new, apparently. Is this?
Hmm?
I'm told this is quite new, this hotel.
Yeah, within a year or two, maybe 3 years, I don't know. So you must be kind of, you've been doing the circuit for like a good 6 months now?
It seems forever. It's just, that's the thing I hadn't banked on, you know, when you finish the film, you think, well, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's just a start. It's, mm-hmm. And then we're doing all this, and then next month the DVD comes out in the UK, so we're doing the whole thing again. You know, it's
just... Now, the one that I love, that it's IFC, I think they're one of the pioneers, that people will get to see this on demand right away.
Yes, which is great, because, you know, it's fine if you're in one of the big cities and you can get that sort of cinema that does that, but if you're in the middle of, you know, somewhere that, you know, it's 100 miles to your nearest.
Right.
It'd be nothing more frustrating than not being, you know, so at least you can just call it up and watch it. Yes, that's great. So many films out that I just don't get a chance to see.
Some people, that, you know, critics will say, you know, something's really funny, I can watch it alone, it doesn't make any difference. But of course, the prevalent view is that it definitely works better if there are people laughing around
you. Yeah.
Which, of course, you're not going to necessarily get in your living room.
No.
But I happen to be the... I think if it's funny, it's funny. I will definitely enjoy it.
Well, yeah, but I think you... I think it's more you feel able to laugh out loud when there are other people there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? So if I watch comedy at home, I'm sort of enjoying it, but I'm not... Do you know what I mean? It's internal laughter. It's not... Mm-hmm. You know, and I can still enjoy it. I still watch, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm come in the city watching it, but I'm not, you know, bellowing.
I've never really laughed out loud once at Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think it's one of the funniest things I've ever
it's
seen.
It's great.
But I never go, ha-ha.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's no specific, there's no release point.
Yeah.
You know, it's a sort of slow build, and then a massive kind of complication. But right. There's no... Because the lines aren't scripted, there's no gag that's delivered in such a way that the response is to kind of laugh right at the end of it. You know, it's,
you know, it's interesting. I've heard comedy writers, people that work for Letterman, and you know, and then they just sit around and they're just coming up with jokes. Those guys are, those women, those men are. You talk to them about comedy, and they know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And they say, look, that's not funny.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, that's funny, but that's not funny, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts.
No,
they say it. That's not, you know.
And there's also the whole difference, you know, the placing of a word in the sentence can make, you know, should that word be at the end, or should we say that at the beginning, or you know, it's when we were writing Alan Partridge, Steve Coogan and I, we used to have these bizarre debates over which numbers were funny, and. Used to be like maybe 15 years ago, odd numbers were funnier than even numbers. So if you said, how old was she? Oh, she was 57. You know, that was funnier. And then we just decided that about 7 or 8 years ago, even numbers became funnier than odd numbers, especially round numbers. How old was she? 50. You know, was suddenly that seemed funnier. And it's all to do with just taste and trends and whatever. It's not a science, but it's just, it's interesting we could sort of sit and analyze that sort of thing.
You know, I'm forgetting now when the UK theatrical opening was.
April. It was April.
Okay.
So yeah, it's constant. We had a whole month of doing that, and then...
Is it common, it's fairly common here, 3 months later, 4 months, a film will be...
Yeah, out. I mean, the thing was, when we made the film, we didn't have any US money in it, so we had a UK distributor in place, so we knew our release date in the UK, but it was only at Sundance that we picked up IFC, so, and then they just need a bit of time to place it and do the campaign and all that sort of thing,
right.
Which hence the sort of gap. I don't know, I think the bigger movies, they try and bring them out simultaneously. I mean, Bruno was out in the UK at the same time as
It is as we speak.
Yeah, it came out last week. But maybe the smaller films, you're sort of picking your distributors up one at a time, and then it comes out in places like Australia and Europe. But I think they're not going to release it until the US release has happened.
I'm very keen on Blu-rays these days, and it seems that often that some of the titles that I'm really into will come out on UK distributors, but they will not. But I'll need an all-region player.
Yes.
Are you a big?
I've tried Blu-ray yet. Good.
Yeah, I've got it here, but I haven't got my all-region player
yet.
Okay.
See.
Yeah. But I'm just. This is like a very. I feel like I'm a kid. This is like the toy, and it just gives me more happiness to get the next
gadget.
Yeah. I mean, or the next great Blu-ray. You know,
right.
Like there's a Polanski Repulsion.
Oh right, yes.
It's out in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. It's got lots of additional stuff around it. And,
it looks better than it's ever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But there's this new thing going on that is a real alarming because it's very new territory. But there's such great specificity and clarity from a Blu-ray that you'll see more vividly the grain,
from the older stock,
that you would not
probably
have seen if you had seen it in the theater.
Yeah,
and what they're doing is trying to be adhere very very loyally to what the film is and not mess with it.
Yeah.
But I feel that they kind of should mess with it.
Does that become distracting, the grain?
Because, does it feel that you're lucky in the middle of a sandstorm or something?
Yeah.
But that's huge. But it's like new territory. So.
Right, okay. Well, so we have we're doing the whole DVD thing next month.
Hmm. You shot this with digital equipment, right?
Yes, HD, because we needed to shoot fast and light and didn't want to do the whole lighting thing of, light for wide shot and then do the, everything stops while we reset to do the reverses and all that. I wanted, and there's two cameras on the go at all times, and I wanted the actors not to feel they had to hit marks. There were no marks, they could just wander wherever they liked and the cameras would follow them around.
Did you happen to see Public Enemies yet?
I haven't seen that, no.
And that was shot again.
Is that HD?
Extreme high D. But this is what I don't understand because I don't work in film. It looks like you're almost watching video.
Right.
It's a widescreen. Right. You get a video texture from
right.
it.
Right.
Now, it is something that's been projected. It has been translated to film.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, unlike your film, which looks like it was shot on film. It doesn't look like
but
video.
But with HD, you can play about with the...
in post, you
the
can
grade,
make it.
You can, uh-huh. you know, and also the, I suppose the setting as you're shooting it as well. You can give it a look. I mean, sometimes, I see films that I can swear they're shot on film stock, but in fact they're HD.
Is there a software that filmmakers use in post to kind of translate it and give it more of a filmic?
I don't know. I'm not as familiar with all. I think I read that. Michael Mann wanted to shoot Public Enemies as a video. Do you know, he wanted to make it feel so he didn't want that notion of what you're watching is something ancient, even though it's set in the 30s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It should feel like you are there.
Yeah, that was my.
Which is why he wants that clean video effect.
That's he's a major. He's a major artist, he's a major, and that's exactly why I think he's so great. But I had this argument after I saw it, and some people thought, this is not what a 1930s film is supposed
exactly,
to be.
But then it becomes a 1930s film, doesn't it? And then it becomes an artifice. It's what he wants to make it feel, convincing.
What are the comic filmmakers, if I could just put you on the spot, who do you have in your, top five or six? Performers as much as people that are
people
writer,
I love Woody Allen. I've always
you know.
What are your favorite Allen films?
Favorite Allen films? I really like Stardust Memories. That's one of my favorite Stardust Memories. And I don't, you don't hear much about it. You know, people don't. I can watch that endlessly, and it's just so, there's so much going on in it.
There's not a lot of real traditional shtick in that film. That's
kind
of
very experimental, and the story is all, you know, playing about with time and the style and jump cuts suddenly happening, and I think it's great. You know, it's just an amazing film, and crimes, misdemeanors, and you know, and Annie Hall, Manhattan, and you know, I start reading them all. Zelig was, I love Zelig.
Somebody was Andrew Saris was interviewed in the New York Times. He says, I don't agree with Woody Allen's view about death, and but he didn't explain what he meant. And the only quote that I can think of from Woody Allen was about death was, that came off the top of my head was, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying.
Yes. and I'm just trying to think of some of the recent ones. There's Husbands and Wives, good one.
I love that film. Yeah. Yeah.
Hannah and Sisters. Yeah. And I just, what I like about Woody Allen is he's not being afraid to try something a little bit different, or to push the style a bit, and really explore what you can do in filmmaking. You know, its ability to play around with big themes and light themes and dark and light and all that. I just don't know. I like Buster Keaton. The next film I want to make a slapstick film. If In the Loop is a sort of screwball comedy, as it were, but done very contemporary, the next thing I want to do is a slapstick with lots of chases and visual gags and visual stunts that don't require CGI and stuff, just actual. I want to do that. What's the Keaton I like? Monty Python films, Spinal Tap. I love Robert Altman. You know, those ensemble, is it like Nashville?
Because there's a pretty persistent strain of satire in Nashville. I mean, there's very little of it. It's all kind of slanted and aimed at that Nashville culture. I mean,
And also the ability to, you know, if you've got a big white canvas and lots of characters, you can make little points.
Right.
By just using one of the characters to kind of explore that area. So I like that. Or comedies that take on like big themes, like The Great Dictator and Doctor Strangelove, but you know that. I'm sort of less into the sort of the romantic comedy, the comedy of little incidents.
You know, when I hear the term romantic comedy, I immediately I don't want to. I don't know if that can work anymore.
Well, I find a lot of them are comedy for the first 40 minutes and then romantic for the next hour. And they keep falling into the trap, and they're always about 20-25 minutes too long because they have to sort the romance out. I really like ones that are quite compact and just full of gags and jokes.
You know, just thinking back to the you know, that isn't funny. One thing that absolutely can never be funny to me is, and I've seen this in, I saw it in Bruno, and it's also in a film that opened and died last weekend called I Love You, Beth Cooper.
Oh, right.
And that's a person is trying to get out some, say what they feel with a song. And they're unquestionably, flagrantly awful.
Right.
And obviously somebody thinks that there's something in that, but when someone doesn't know how to sing, it's just not funny.
Not funny. Is it deliberate bad singing? Is that what it is? Or is
I don't know why, but they...
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And I was saying, why do they do this? This is like so not. You know.
There's a couple of films that I've been told are really good that I haven't seen yet. This one's Hangover, I haven't seen yet.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah, I'm told that's funny.
No, that's kind of a genre, you know, what happened last night, well, we got so drunk. But that's actually pretty good.
And Adam was telling me about
it. I wouldn't say it's way up there.
No, okay.
But it's a good B
plus. People have been saying,
yeah.
And Adam was telling me about Hump Day.
I think that's superb myself.
Oh, right.
But that's more, almost in terms of like the behavior, the acting is wonderful. And a lot of it's, you know, just as they had an idea of what they're doing, but they improv.
Right, right.
Good, really
solid. See if I can, Adam, get hold of it. He was saying it's really good.
Yeah. Mumblecore movie.
Oh, right. Is that what it's, is that a genre?
Right. We're not, it's almost like preordained, and not very much is going to happen.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
Yes. But, yes.
And showing my son the another mumblecore movie, he said, boy, this, you know, this is like, there's nothing happening here. I said, but it's, but you got to watch the actors and get into the whole.
I thought Superbad was a bit like that, actually. I quite enjoyed Superbad. You know, but it is basically just one night, people just aimlessly trying to find something, and, you know, just.
My son, who's 21, he owns that film. He does cartwheels over that film. And it's because it's, I guess, you know, there's very good character work.
Great. Yeah, great performances, aren't they? Yeah. That's the thing. It's, and you know, certain films I've seen where, in the end, I've enjoyed it more for the performances than maybe for the writing, you know. There are all these patches of plot and story still being resolved and romance still being, but you stay with it because you actually find the performances are endearing or interesting. You know.
Whenever I complain about a comedy, I'll say, I don't believe that would happen in a second. I say, well, you know, it's a comedy, Jeff. I said, look, because something is comedy doesn't mean that it's a license to be completely divorced from the world.
No, absolutely. You know. I mean, I found in when I was in the edit, I found I was taking some jokes out because I'm thinking, under those circumstances, he would not have the time to think of a line like that. You know what I mean? And it somehow, even though it's a funny line, it kind of destroys the scene because it makes it unreal. You know, and so I'm. Having, you know, I'm cutting gags out to make the film funnier. And sometimes it's just the look.
So you then, you know, infer that all comedies have to adhere to the same rules.
Yeah,
as
have its own. It sort of, the film sets its own rules, but once it's set those rules, it has to then stick to them. It can't then just break.